It's absolute bullcrap. That is the Heather McCoy Show. That was awesome. Let's do that again sometime. Hopefully Juju is up next week. We'll see. We'll see if Jamie Stewart gets his cell phone working. Until then, this is the Heather McCoy Show.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Vocal Improv Jam, taking place monthly on the first Sunday at 4:30 p.m. at Riverfront Commemorative Park in Corvallis. The Vocal Improv Jam is open to all, with no experience or music background needed. The jam is based on Bobby McFerrin's Circle Singing. The event explores and develops musicality in a safe, supportive, and fun setting. Again, that's the Vocal Improv Jam this month on Sunday, June 2nd from 4:30 to 6 p.m. at Riverfront Commemorative Park, 2nd Northwest 1st Street in Corvallis. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 11 o'clock. Coming up next on Between the Covers, host David Naiman talks to Morgan Parker about her new book, Magical Negro. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
Join us on Sunday, June 2nd from 2 to 4 p.m. for KBOO's 51st birthday party and birthday cake potluck. Bring a birthday cake if you can and celebrate the existence of 51 wonderful years of grassroots, volunteer-run, independent community radio serving Portland, Cascadia, and the world. KBOO is an independent, member-supported, non-commercial, volunteer-powered community radio station. KBOO embodies equitable social change, shared knowledge, and fosters creativity by delivering locally rooted and diverse music, culture, news, and opinions with a commitment to the voices of oppressed and underserved communities. Again, that's KBOO's 51st birthday party and birthday cake potluck on Sunday, June 2nd from 2 to 4 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/51birthday party.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and more for a breakfast and lunch. Grendel's Coffee House is open daily until 6 p.m. More information is available on Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550. That's 503-595-9550.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is poet, essayist, and soon-to-be novelist Morgan Parker. Parker is the author of the poetry collections Other People's Comfort Keeps Me Up at Night from Switchback Books, which was selected by Eileen Miles for the 2013 Gatewood Prize, and was a finalist for the Poetry Society of America's Norma Farber First Book Award, and the poetry collection There Are More Beautiful Things Than Beyoncé from Tin House Books, picked by Oprah and Time Magazine as one of the best books of 2017, a book that inspired Kiese Layman to say that there is no more daring artist or anyone he'd rather read in the 21st century than Morgan Parker. Parker received her bachelor's degree in anthropology and a creative writing degree from Columbia University, and her MFA in poetry from NYU. Her poetry and essays have been published and anthologized in the Paris Review, The Breakbeat Poets, New American Poetry in the Age of Hip Hop, Best American Poetry 2016, The New York Times, and The Nation. Parker is the recipient of a 2017 National Endowment of the Arts Literature Fellowship, winner of a Pushcart Prize, and is a Cave Canem Graduate Fellow. She's also the host of Reparations Live, co-curates the Poets with Attitude reading series with Tommy Pico, and with Angel Nafis, she is the Other Black Girl Collective. Morgan Parker returns to Between the Covers to talk about her third poetry collection, Magical Negro, from Tin House Books. Dinesh Smith says 2019 justly belongs to Morgan Parker. Her poems shred me with their intelligence, dark humor, and black-hearted vision. Diego Baez at Booklist calls Magical Negro a profound meditation on the history and future of black liberation, a searing indictment, an irreverent lampoon, and a desperately urgent work of poetry. And Patricia Smith says, if you're anxious for your snug perspective to be rattled and ripped asunder, for the predictable landscape you stroll to become all but unrecognizable, for things you thought you knew to slap you into another consciousness, brethren, have I got the book for you. Bay's bestie continues her reign with this restless, fierce, and insanely inventive way of walking through the world. Once again, children, ignore Miss Parker at your peril. Welcome back to Between the Covers.
Hi.
Morgan Parker.
Thank you.
So you've talked in many interviews about how Magical Negro is different than your previous two collections, that it was the hardest book you've written, the most serious, the most urgent. And you've mentioned the comment of friend Jason P. Smith after he read some of the poems in it, when he said, oh, you don't care about being charming anymore. So let's start with a compare and contrast. Talk to us about the ways in which Magical Negro extends what you've been working on before and the ways it's a shift, whether in tone or strategy or content.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of the poems in this book, actually, I had written and were kind of originally part of There Are More Beautiful Things Than Beyoncé. And in the making of that book, I started to see some differences in the poems and I guess the kind of sub-themes of the poems. I'm always going to be talking about roughly the same things. So it was interesting to see a shift in how I was talking about those things or which kind of, what was being echoed and what was showing up over and over. And I think a lot of this book as building off of my first two and responding to even, you know, the responses of those books. I think I've been thinking a lot about how There Are More Beautiful Things Than Beyoncé is, folks love it, and white people love it, and I'm very, very grateful for that, and I'm really grateful for the kind of wideness of the audience. But there started, you know, as the book was out and did its thing, I started to feel that there were some parts that were overlooked or misread, and my job as a writer is to just kind of keep sharpening what I feel was left unsaid or to reiterate something. And I do think that, you know, there's no sparkly, you know, playing with Beyoncé and that sort of, there is popular culture, but it's less of this drawing you in and saying, let's have some fun with this. So I think to remove all of that and force readers to look at the undersides was the project of this book. And I think that a lot had to do with, you know, the years I was writing this book. It was just death everywhere, as usual. And a lot of the rhetoric and language and hashtags around all of that stuff was just insufficient for me. And I wanted to use a lot of the work that I'd done in the last book in terms of speaking about what it feels like to be a black woman and what the various kind of dangers and traumas and fears are around that life. I just wanted to go a little bit deeper into that. And I think part of that was like delving into history and making it clear that I and the women in my community are part of a really long legacy of people who have travailed, you know? And I think, I think about now more than ever, and that kind of language, which, you know, I've heard used to speak about my work. And I'm like, no. Let me get something clear. It was definitely harder. It was hard for me with a lot of the poems to even, you know, look back at them after I drafted them and say, oh, like, that's what I was trying to say. And I think I just took away the impulse to cover that up at all, or prettify it in any kind of way.
As you moved away in this book from being of wanting to charm people, you said before that you were concerned about scaring people away in your previous collections, and so the drawing people in, let's say with Beyonce,
mm-hmm.
and then doing a switch and saying, well, actually, this book's about something else.
Totally.
And this book, you've dispensed with the charming people away, and you're not concerned about scaring people away. But the paradox of that is, you've said that you were particularly terrified for how this book would be in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So how has the reality of Magical Negro been since it's come out for you, and compared to your expectations or your anxieties about it?
The reception has been awesome. So I think people are accessing it in ways that I did not expect, and understanding it and contextualizing it in ways that I am really, really happy about. It's been hard for me personally. I said at one event, I didn't put enough jokes in this book. And that's not for anyone else. That's because I'm on stages every day mm-hmm. reading these things over and over. And that is not fun at all. You know, that's really an additional struggle. And, you know, to kind of relive these very vulnerable and tough moments of my life in American history over and over is, you know, it's for a larger good, but it doesn't feel good to me.
Yeah.
So that part is really difficult.
Well, one of my favorite public conversations you've had about the book so far is with Candace Williams at Electric Literature.
Mm-hmm.
And the last time you were on the show, we talked about the Magical Negro phenomenon, the benevolent, one-dimensional, magical black figure that comes to the aid of the dimensional white protagonist in relationship to your last collection. But in your conversation with Candace, you talk about the dangers of reclaiming the magical label,
mm-hmm.
That even though you were in, for instance, the Black Girl Magic anthology, and you support that endeavor, that just saying black people are magical is problematic on the flip side when we think about Michael Brown being seen as mm-hmm. a devil and Rodney King having Hulk-like strength.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to us about Magical Negro, the poetry collection, in this light, in the light of how you wanted your work to engage with this problematic phenomenon of magic beyond the response of just flipping the narrative to its reverse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting and sticky because it is the same, you know, it's a sharp edge on either side, you know? And it's similar, I think, to There Are More Beautiful Things Than Beyonce, where I was thinking a lot about beauty, obviously, and what it is like to at once kind of put black women on this pedestal, but also exploit their bodies, that kind of double-edged thing. That same theme is working here where I talked a little bit about that with the last book as well, because it was very Obama era of like, there's this, you know, black president and then everyone's getting killed. And that seems totally fine to everyone. And I think there's a lot of that kind of like holding those two things in your mind. That was really working on me as I was writing this book. And I love the kind of reclaiming the narrative of, you know, and especially with young women, seeing them say black girls are magic. I love that. And it's we know that it's sort of true. But the more it's said not by us, sometimes I get a little bit uncomfortable, because it is another way to cut down and to, I guess not recognize one's humanity. That is really what this book is about, I think, is I think there's a line that says, what it feels like to not be able to see a person. That really is at the heart of this. And I think it's really troubling and heartbreaking to me the way that a kind of cultural understanding of a people as magical or mythical in some kind of way, how dangerous that can become. And it's not, it becomes, it maybe begins as a kind of respect for survival and incredible strength, but then it becomes a way to justify not understanding someone's humanity. Mm-hmm. And it really, you know, I often think about, you know, police officers saying that they truly felt threatened for their lives. And I think, you know, I kind of don't blame them. I mean, I blame them, but that makes sense to me, because if we're culturally only seeing certain images and versions of Black people, and these folks, these, you know, police officers of communities somehow have never, you know, encountered an intimate relationship with a Black person, then of course they would be afraid, you know? And that is, that's really, it's just heartbreaking to me. And I think something worth thinking about, you know, just how the images and the language that we use and have used for years and centuries, the things that are kind of underneath the American consciousness, how that affects our day-to-day kind of interactions with people. And I think, you know, we forget that there's all these kind of unconscious things working and interrupting and interfering with those relationships. And it really starts to needle, and it really kind of starts to add up. So this book really was like an opportunity for me to point that out and just like beg for my humanity to be seen. And in that way, again, it's like way more vulnerable and just like coming out of a lot of pain and frustration, really, where, you know, I feel that there's so much I've said that has been heard, and yet, you know, and I think this book really is about that particular type of Black exhaustion in 2019.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've said in relationship to this book, it's becoming increasingly important for us to document ourselves. We're reflected in these major ways, but it's still never enough. It's still never specific enough. Mm-hmm. It's still not exactly in our words. And I wondered if that is the key to this collection, that the collection is motivated by documentation and specification.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of the titles of the three sections, Let Us Now Praise Famous Magical Negroes, Field Negro Field Notes, and Popular Negro Punchlines, and also the titles of some of the poems, like Magical Negro Number 84, or Magical Negro Number 3, or Black Women for Beginners Part 1, all of which give this sense of cataloging and a sense of the anthropological. So I was hoping maybe you could talk a little bit about the thought process there.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, because my other books, I didn't necessarily have such a structured kind of and more of a theoretical concept around the books, and something that was just exciting to me. You know, I am like obsessed with documentation, and I save everything, and I've been just kind of investigating that in myself, that impulse. And that just seemed fun to like mark down what I think my legacy is, or my history is, and to specifically just like write down what my stuff and my experience in the world is, and using a lot of that kind of anthropological, like self-ethnography kind of thing. And it just, it was a lot more kind of heady conceptualizing when I started working on this book as a collection, not necessarily the poems, but I did one of the first attempts I made at kind of making the taking this from poems to book was organizing it by these almost as, you know, an ethnography, and having these different sections and thinking about like a Malinowski, where it's like, here's how the people gift. Here's like what relationships are like.
Right.
And, you know, I've read a lot of like anthropological books, so I wanted to kind of borrow from that structure. And that's another way to interact with this, like, dehumanizing by studying. I don't know. I think it's a really interesting and weird form, especially to use on your own community and yourself. So to kind of take that more, that wider lens structure and use it for the more personal was a fun thing to play with, and also I think helpful for me, so that it wasn't just like, here's a lot of really tough feelings, to figure out how to present them in a way that really was a catalog and really was this kind of living archive, and that has to do, you know, the field notes of it, that section I really wanted to redefine some things, you know, almost as if there is, you know, a particular dictionary of blackness that I am writing, in that dictionary, this is what the word mat means. Mm-hmm. This is what, here is like a case study of being in the African braid shop. You know, these kind of reworking languages and imagery, and that's part of the changing the magical Negro and figuring out what my magical Negroes are and those kind of specific titles and specific figures. That was really fun and also felt really open, you know, that I kind of was able to do whatever. And there were a lot of poems that I tried that didn't make it in here, but that was kind of the thought experiment behind a lot of it, of just like, what does this word mean to us? What does this action mean to us? How do I like redefine these things again in our own words and organize them so that there is this kind of, so that it's on paper, that is very documented, and that it's something that is alive and can be added to?
Well, it seems fitting that the book opens with a poem whose title is taken from a line by Zora Neale Hurston, because she was often described, rightly or wrongly, as taking an anthropological approach
mm-hmm.
to her nonfiction writing. So I was hoping maybe you could read "I Feel Most Colored When I'm Thrown Against a Sharp White Background."
Absolutely. Zora studied anthropology at Barnard, and I did at Columbia, and there was like a picture of her when I went into the anthropology
oh, wow.
building. So she really is, you know, underneath a lot of this work. And one reason that I feel I feel permission to engage in that way. So love her. "I feel most colored when I am thrown against a sharp white background. Or I feel sharp white, or colored against, or I am thrown, I am against, or when white, I sharp, I color, quiet, forget, my country is a boat. I feel most colored when I swear to God. I feel most colored when it is too late, when I am captive. The last thing on my mind is death. I tongue elegy. I color green because green is the color of power. I am growing two fruits. I feel most colored when I am thrown against the sidewalk. It is the last time I feel colored. Stone is the name of the fruit. I am a man, I am a man, I am a woman, I am a man, I am a woman, I am protected and served. I background my country sharp in my throat. I pay taxes, and I am a child, and I grow into a bright, fleshy fruit. White bites. I stain the uniform. I am thrown black typeface in a headline with no name, or no one hears me. I am thrown bone, unarmed. I feel most colored when my weapon is I, when I get what I deserve, when I can't breathe. When on television I shuffle and widen my eyes. I feel most colored when I am thrown against a mattress. My tits, my waist, my ankles buried in white ash. Everyone claps. I feel most colored when I am the punchline, when I am the trigger. In the dawn, putrid yellow, I know what I am being told. My country is on my grave. My country bigger than God. Elegy my country. I feel most colored when I am collecting dust, when I am impatient and sick. They use us to distract us. My ears leak violet petals. I sharpen them. I sharpen them again. Everyone claps.
We've been listening to Morgan Parker read from Magical Negro from Tin House. When I see all of the poems with numbers like Magical Negro, number 217, Diana Ross finishing a rib in Alabama, 1990s, or Magical Negro, number 607, Gladys Knight on the 200th episode of The Jeffersons, I have two feelings at once. And one is what you've been describing already, one that I'm witnessing a certain sort of archiving of very specific things and things that might not otherwise get archived.
Mm-hmm.
But it also alerts me. The numbers also alert me to that I'm reading something that is part of a larger work that isn't all here in front of me. And I also get the feeling with the poem you just read with the acknowledgement. So, for instance, the poem doesn't just say after Zora Neale Hurston mm-hmm. to acknowledge your debt to her, but instead the line says after Glenn Ligon, after Zora Neale Hurston, which sort of creates a chain.
Mm-hmm.
We get Zora Neale Hurston's words, and then we get the artist who put her words into his installation to disembark, and then your poem mm-hmm. is creating another link, or at least that's the way I read it a little bit. So I was curious if you see that as this as part of the archival activity is also sort of the connecting to these other figures.
Definitely. Yeah, I love Glenn Ligon's work and like have a tattoo of one of the neon signs that he has made, and a lot of them are using this language. And you know what's really funny about those? I mean, some of the work that Glenn Ligon plays with is from Gertrude Stein, which I also use that kind of quote. And I think that there's a way that we pick up on little things and they get kind of repeated, and that is fun to connect to other artists and moments in time and add something else to it. And just add another layer. Not that their work was incomplete, but to build on something and to look back. That was a big part of this book is the looking backward and the making connections. So I do feel that it was fun to think about what do I want to be in conversation with.
So you've said before in other interviews that emotional statements and personal statements, particularly coming from women, aren't taken as seriously. That if you're emotional, you are suddenly illogical.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's this misconception to think that emotion can even be divorced from logic and clarity to begin with. So I was interested in that statement in relationship to using outside language
mm-hmm.
In this book. So in this case, the language of anthropology, which you've said gives, and I think it does, you've said that this language gives something more credence.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if do you employ this language twinned with a woman who's a poet being emotional as a way to sort of reveal the machinery through which we're manipulated by language?
Absolutely.
You do.
I think languages obviously I'm a poet, but you know, language is so interesting and so important to how we understand ourselves and other people. And I think more so than we realize, you know, and the way that language works on us, the way that certain words being repeated, word choices. I was talking yesterday to a friend about this essay I was working on about this sermon given by Bob Jones of Bob Jones University, who, among so many other egregious things, mentions when the slaves came over here from Africa. And I was like, just that word came, you know, like, mm-hmm. What does that mean for us to, for that to be used and for people to hear that? And I just, those sorts of things I'm really tuned into, and I really wanted to have a chance to point them out. And of course, you know, the way that women's words can be misconstrued, the way that we start to drown out familiar grievances, I guess. So my challenge was, how do I put these things into words where you almost aren't expecting it to be emotional, or you are and that's not what happens, to just like play with that expectation and to see what readers find is more authoritative, you know? I think there's a way in which it's easy to take authority away from a women poet, you know? But this, using that language, like, I know that language, you know? I've read an academic book, and what does it mean to rephrase and use your language to talk to you about my stuff, mm-hmm. because clearly it wasn't working for me to do it in my words. And, you know, that's fun also. It's also like poking fun at that when you're reading and realize, oh, I actually did engage with this in a different way because it is written in this particular language. What does that mean? So the experience of reading the poem is at once, you know, understanding the content of it, but also understanding how the form is playing with that delivery of the content.
Yeah. Could we hear a couple more poems?
Absolutely.
So I was thinking Black Women for Beginners, Part One, and We Are the House That Holds the Table at Which, Yes, We Will Happily Take a Goddamn Seat.
Yes. Black Women for Beginners, Part One. Every time a hot comb simmers, we dread. We get hurt so often, we think it's a nickname. When we say we remember, we mean hurricane, hunt, meadow, lust, duty, escape, settle, mourn, birch, baptism, tithe, kneel, Sphinx, throat, offering, animal, deadwood. We get hurt so often, we never run. Every time we lick our lips, the day obeys and repents. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Hot comb on the stove, train tracks in the weeds. We are the house that holds the table at which, yes, we will happily take a goddamn seat. After Solange. No one can serve two masters like we can. Be future and what they threatened to forget. Be Richard Pryor live on Sunset and be the sunset. Kiss the ground, burn it to the ground. Slay dragon, speak dragon. Sometimes it feels like we invented America ourselves. The difference between worth and worthless without them is science. How it feels to not be able to see a person, and the number of instances when we believed we should die. For dinner, watermelon and a dry white. Gin nightcap. Low moon. How fucking dare we? The probability of a wave carrying a pearl in its mouth is the probability of a lamb slicing its own white neck, tying its legs to a spit for someone else's feast.
Been listening to Morgan Parker read from her latest poetry collection, Magical Negro. So another thing that I think underlies Magical Negro's archival impulse is a question of absences and gaps and of erasure. There is all the history that's lost in the middle passage, but there's also history that doesn't have to be lost, that could be told but isn't. For mm-hmm. instance, in the poem, who are Frederick Douglass's cousins and other Nancy Myers in your poem, Nancy Myers in My Dream of Whiteness, the director of Hollywood blockbusters like The Parent Trap, none of which have black protagonists, or the title of the first section, Let Us Now Praise Famous Magical Negroes, which is a nod to James Agee's work, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, mm-hmm. which was looking at three tenant farm families, but all of which were also white. What I loved about this is that the poems and titles, they work in their own way, even if you don't know Nancy Myers, and even if you don't know of Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, mm-hmm. but you are missing something if you don't, but you don't know you're missing something, which in a way sort of echoes the experience of what you miss when you're not taught something.
Mm-hmm.
So you're sitting in school and you're only hearing one thing and you don't necessarily have the context of what you could be hearing. I just wanted to hear a little bit about that for you in terms of how you're employing this in Magical Negro.
Yeah, and a lot of that is a kind of afterward realization of, wait, why do I only know this stuff? And what else is there? Wait a minute, like this has been presented to me in an incomplete way. And I think a lot about using different references, and you know, folks are always, you know, in a tough about, you know, timelessness or whatever, and whether or not pop cultural markings are allowed in poetry. I do think a lot about who can access what. And I like to have things where you can get it if you don't know the reference, but you also can get a little bit more if you do know it. But that it's not, you know, isolating anyone. I think that is really empowering, to use kind of inside language. And sometimes it's just for me. Like, these are the references that I know. Nancy Myers, sometimes when I'm reading that poem, I'm like, do you guys know who this is? And the only way I know how to explain, I'm like, you know the movies with the amazing kitchens? Like, that's... And then people are like, oh, yeah, we're here with you.
That's hilarious.
I think all of the references also point to a bunch of other things. So mm-hmm. They're more accessible in that way, where, yes, it's Nancy Myers, but there's a larger kind of thing at play that anyone can recognize if you've seen a movie in the past, you know, 30 years.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Yeah, I wanted to sort of twin this to something that you said in the interview with The Believer, which I just loved. So The Believer magazine did a series in the shadow of Trump's post-truth presidency, and they asked different writers their relationship to facts. And you had the most amazing answer when they said, what is a fact to you? So this is what you said. Part of my project is to make my own myths. It's a lot of rewriting and reimagining. I always say the craziest thing about the transatlantic slave trade is that so much history was lost. Names, birthdays, every kind of fact. I was never afforded that historically. Facts are white. It almost feels like facts don't belong to me. So people of color created their own myths. Facts aren't for me. And I love the way, I love this, and I love the way you flip the script, because it reminds me of a comment Toni Morrison made in the 1980s. Where she said, from my perspective, there are only black people. When I say people, that's what I mean. And I guess I wondered if this idea of facts being white is linked to the literal gaps that appear in your book, mm-hmm. the gaps between the front teeth of Angela Davis, James Baldwin, and Malcolm X. So these black spaces and absences that seem to be the source of their beauty in
mm-hmm,
a way.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to us a little bit about writing not just against a sharp white background, but also writing in the presence of absences or from or into a black gap.
I do think a lot about absence and erasure, and particularly just what isn't seen or shown, you know, in terms of media and imagery and which stories are told over and over and which aren't. That's part of it. And I also think that part of it is trying to name that special magic, if you will, of which isn't public, you know, and is a little bit ephemeral and interior. Yeah, the kind of ineffable magic is something that is always almost lost, I think. And that has to do with the shaping of what we see as facts. There's room for flexibility, I think, and fluidity in what is a fact. And it really, you know, the way that we prioritize fact and truth and whatever is feels very supremacist and constructed and controlling almost. So I did want to push back on what is actually true versus what I see and what we as a people feel. Yeah, facts are why. My therapist brings, I sent her that because I talk about this stuff in therapy, and she loves it. She brings it up all the time. She's like, what was that you said? Facts are white. Which, you know, I kind of, after I said that, I was like, what did I just say in this interview? But I do really believe that the way that Black Americans operate is something other than true fact. You know, that's in our language, that's in the way that we play the dozens and the way that we tell stories. Like, all of that is, we don't need actual facts. That's just not how we speak, and that's not how we exist and move through the world. I think it's something else.
Let's hear Frederick Douglass's Cousins, because I think this poem speaks to that a little too.
Awesome. Who were Frederick Douglass's cousins and other quotidian Black history facts that I wish I learned in school? I have a body. It sits in a desk. Every day is bitten with new guilt. My teacher can see right through me, all the way to Black History Month. It is my fortune to be ashamed and from nowhere. How can I concentrate on photosynthesis when there is a thing called Africa? When my teacher talks about slaves, I become a slave. I know too much. I raise my hand. American flag and family tree. Is it my fault my stomach aches? I wait in my desk and try to be still. I lie and immediately confess. I grow a plant in a paper towel. I get in trouble for talking. At recess, I pretend. The mountains are closing in. I am good, but too curious. What happened to the Indians? How do we know about heaven and dragonflies? Where did Harriet Tubman sleep? Who did Harriet Tubman kiss? What about the Africans that stayed? Why are they hungry? Did Frederick Douglass's mother brush his hair in the morning? Was he tender-headed and afraid? Is this how I'm supposed to feel? Are you sure? How do you know?
I've been listening to Morgan Parker read from Magical Negro. In your interview with Kaveh Akbar at Dive Dapper, you characterized your first book as very inward, your second as looking at the people around the self, and this book is taking even a further step back, surveying a larger group of people. And you said that this distance allows you to be harsher, and that perhaps you wanted this distance because of the anger you felt that you keep writing about the same themes across books and still feel like certain things aren't being picked up on, which you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation mm-hmm. too, that you aren't entirely being heard. And similarly, in your conversation with Candace Williams, you say that part of your fear around this new book coming out is that you put so much of yourself into it that you hurt yourself in doing so, and that you can't stand the idea that you will have done all this emotional work and be read over. So talk to us about your frustration about things that you don't feel people are hearing and what some of that might be, and also what you mean by being read over.
Mm-hmm. I've been thinking a lot about this lately, mostly because I've been doing this just abhorrent thing where I like name drop my Ivy League education, which is the worst. I mean, that's like it's such a bad look. But I find myself doing this in conversations and readings, because there's a way, again, that Black women's poems are often only read for the content, and there's less of a discussion about craft and rigor. And I think that's the stuff. It happens a lot more subtly, and I think it's easier and more fun, I guess, or whatever, for folks to just be like, this is powerful and urgent and Black people, you know, like yeah. to pick up on certain.
You often see the word raw.
Yeah,
which is
exactly.
That contrast to crafted.
Absolutely. You know, this feeling that these are just like my emotions spilled on the page. That's not true. They are very vulnerable, but they've been worked over and over and played with. And I've done a lot of work to try to get every word right. And often I see a kind of unwillingness to understand that part of the book, you know, a kind of willful ignorance of that part and just focusing on the content's connection to a cultural conversation about Blackness, which is all correct, but, you know, the poetry is so special because it can do more than just say, here's how I feel as a Black woman, you know, here are some things that make me afraid or upset, but also to say them in a way that makes the reader feel those things in a different kind of way. And the form and word choice and wordplay is as important as the content, you know? I just think it's important to talk more about that in literature. And it's very interesting the way that, you know, I talk about this with other Black women writers, where it seems like everyone's always asking about the content, whereas, you know, I've seen talks with my white male writer friends, and it's a lot about, you know, the craft and the intelligence and the way that the book was written, and less about, you know, is this your experience in the world, and what do you think about America and interracial dating or whatever? I think there's more of a willful ignorance of the other stuff, and people seem so much more interested in just our like interior lives in a way that's very unfair for writers, you know, and misses a lot of the point. And it just feels, I don't know. I'm still trying to work out like what it is that upsets me, but I think part of it is that, you know, to be, you know, doing all these interviews and Q&As and all these things, to be only answering questions about like how I feel and how America feels and how America should feel is frankly exhausting and boring. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not here as like a political representative. I have no PhD in American studies or anything like that. But I did study poetry and I understand like how to talk about these things that are very real and present and personal, but to do so by using the craft of poetry specifically. You know, I write essays and other things, and that is a different sort of way of accessing the work. So I just, you know, I guess I just miss some of the connecting the form and the craft to the content. Mm-hmm. I think, again, it's just easier to kind of write off our words as just emotional and I've heard stream of consciousness, which is crazy. That's not how I feel. My diaries do not look like this. And yeah, I think that's part of it. It's just like, it's easier to kind of ignore the intelligence and skill of Black women. And I hate to have to be like, you know, I've gotten your degrees. Like, I know what I'm doing. So a friend told me recently that after a reading, an older white man came up to her and was like, I don't know if you knew that you were doing this in your poem, which is like, yes, wow. We know what we're doing. You know, it's not like we're just here spitting out how we feel and like not playing. Like, there are subtleties that, yes, we're aware of and that one can study that is larger than just like, oh, me, I feel indicted as a white person or whatever. I don't know. It's something that has been interesting for me to watch. And like, as a nerd, I'm kind of like, I would love to talk about the line and how playing with form can interact with content. But
well, I have a question that's specific to what you're just saying that is about the line, because I do want to unpack the different ways in which you use repetition mm-hmm. in the book, because I think it has multiple ways in which it's affecting the reader. But one of them I wondered about is when we get these phrases repeated and that reappear and echo throughout the collection, if part of that is an insistence on your part that in specific to this very thing that you're saying, listen to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, I keep saying it in terms of, I don't know if this is heard in my past work, but it really is, I don't know if I'm heard ever, you know? And I think that's the larger thing at play. Are you hearing me? Are you hearing all of us? We've been saying the same forever, and yet, and I think that's what is underneath. Like, it's less so about my reception, you know, in the world and in literature, and more about history and repetition and the repetition that wears us down and the kind of... It's clearly at this point, I think I'm being very clear. So if folks aren't, getting it, we're saying, all right, we have lives that are... that matter, you know, basic like that. Folks who can't get with that, that's, you're choosing not to see that stuff. And I think that nothing is passive. And so the insistence is pointing that out. And I think not letting myself or anyone get away with rushing past facts about our lives and rushing past real concerns that we have. So I don't know. This book is a lot about repetition throughout history. You know, I think a lot about what are the kind of frustrations that I've inherited from the moment I was born, and how those things kind of repeat throughout our lives in various different ways. The repetition of a Matt sort of dude, and the repetition of feeling gaslit, and the repetition of feeling cut down and dehumanized, and all of that. So to have that in the form and to have the reader experience that sort of insistency and repetition is a way of trying to make the reader feel as I do, you know? And to try to, it's not just about saying the thing, it's about feeling the thing over and over.
Well, I'd love to end with the final poem in the book, but before we do, I just wanted to ask a brief question to set it up, because when we arrive at the end of the book, we realize it loops back to the beginning, which I feel like is wonderful when we are talking about linear time being white, and here we are at the end, but we're really not at the end, we're at the beginning, or everything's happening at once.
Exactly.
But the beginning is an epigraph of some racist lines by Gertrude Stein, and the end is a poem that I think dismantles, engages with and dismantles those words in a way.
Yeah.
Is that the right reading of that?
Certainly.
I just wanted to hear why you wanted to bookend the book with Gertrude Stein's words ultimately.
Yeah, I'm so compelled to that that language and who's speaking it. So much of the book, I keep saying it's funny, my last book had an epigraph of Kendrick Lamar, and now for this book called Magical Negro, it's Gertrude Stein, which is weird and unexpected, but I think because so much of this book is about that historic repetition and the propaganda-ness of our experience, it's often about how we're being spoken about by white people. And I wanted the book to be an answer and an anecdote to that, or sorry, antidote to that. So I think it's important that you begin this book, which is very much black and out of blackness, but to begin it with someone else's kind of description, I suppose, or vision of blackness. And it's also, you know, a joyful quote, kind of. And what does that mean when spoken by her versus us?
And also it's a white canonical poet. So when we think about being thrown against the sharp white background from Zora Neale Hurston, it's like Magical Negro with the background of the white canon.
Yep.
Too.
In terms of ending the book there, that surprised me. I wasn't particularly planning to do something like that, but the poem came after I had decided to have that be the epigraph. And honestly, when I got to the end of that poem, I was like, well, there's nothing I can put after this, you know? And yeah. I think that is...
It's a fantastic ending.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And it is one of those things where I was like, well, maybe this can go somewhere else, but no, it just can't. And I think there's something really exciting about getting through the book to that. And it hurts in the right way, and it's like a joke in the right way.
Well, let's hear it.
Okay. It was summer now, and the colored people came out into the sunshine. They descend from the boat two by two. The gap in Angela Davis's teeth speaks to the gap in James Baldwin's teeth. The gap in James Baldwin's teeth speaks to the gap in Malcolm X's teeth. The gap in Malcolm X's teeth speaks to the gap in Malcolm X's teeth. The gap in Condoleezza Rice's teeth doesn't speak. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard kisses the Band-Aid on Nellie's cheek. Frederick Douglass's side part kisses Nikki Giovanni's Thug Life tattoo. The choir is led by Whoopi Goldberg's eyebrows. The choir is led by Will Smith's flat top. The choir loses its way. The choir never returns home. The choir sings funeral instead of wedding, sings funeral instead of allegedly, sings funeral instead of help, sings black instead of grace, sings black as knucklebone, mercy, June bug, sea air. It is time for war.
Thank you so much for coming back on Between the Covers,
Morgan.
Thank
you. Always a true delight.
We're talking today to poet Morgan Parker about her latest collection from Tin House Books, Magical Negro, and you've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Black Queer Pride Celebration on Sunday, June 2nd, from noon to 4:30 p.m. at Multnomah County Central Library in Portland. The Black Queer Pride Celebration explores what it means to be Black, queer, and in Portland with a panel discussion, performances, and more to honor the resilience and uplift the voices of the most marginalized. Again, that's the Black Queer Pride Celebration on Sunday, June 2nd from noon to 4:30 p.m. at Multnomah County Central Library, 801 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO May Board of Directors meeting will happen on Monday, June 3rd at 6 p.m. because of the Memorial Day holiday. The June board meeting will take place at the regular date and time, 6 p.m. on the fourth Monday of the month.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio station. Welcome to Shocks of Sheba.